Freedom of thought in education, is good education conformity to a standard, was presented by David Crabtree at the 2008 Oktoberfest conference entitled Freedom of Thought, Hollow Slogan or Purposeful Practice. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Thank you. Freedom of thought is a term that's regarded with favor in our culture. It has a magic word in it, freedom. Freedom always has a positive connotation in our culture. I think that's interesting. And so freedom of thought, it's got to be a good thing. But it is something that is rarely talked about, actually. And it is something that is even rarer to find in our day and age. It is given lip service, but it really isn't honored in practice. And that's what I want to explore, is why is that the case? You do hear conversations about freedom of speech, and I'm going to mince finely. I'm not talking about freedom of speech here. The conversations that you hear about freedom of speech usually are in the context of talking heads on television, where someone is advocating freedom of speech, and it's because they have a perspective that it is not widely embraced, and their assumption is it must not be widely embraced because it isn't getting out there enough. And so they become advocates of freedom of speech. My suspicion is that in many cases, if their perspective was embraced by the majority, they would cease to be advocates of freedom of speech. But nevertheless, I suspect that there are some sincere advocates of freedom of speech, but I'm not doing that today. I am in favor of freedom of speech, but that's not my topic. Freedom of speech has implications for our life together as a society. Freedom of thought has implications for us as individuals before our God. Academic freedom is a related topic, and an important topic. But in many instances, academic freedom is really the freedom of teachers and students to express their views freely in an academic setting. And it is largely the same as freedom of speech. So I want to talk specifically about freedom of thought in an educational setting. And what I'm going to contend is that what role freedom of thought plays in education depends on what you think education is. As one's perspective on education changes and what its goal is, then the role of freedom of thought will change accordingly. And I'm going to argue that we have reached a point in history where the understanding that we have as to what education is and what its purpose is has basically relegated freedom of thought to a very small role, if any, and in some instances is seen as a deterrent to the process of education. And that's what I want to chart out for you. Being trained in history, it seems to me that history can shed light on the present, and I would like to trace back in the history of education in America, just very briefly, how we got here. And this will be very brief. 5 years ago, I gave a topic here at Oktoberfest on academic freedom, and I went into greater length on some of this history. So this will be a briefer account, and I've selected out certain things that I want to highlight. Let's go back to colonial times. Colonial education was primarily religiously motivated. The goal of education in colonial times was to prepare young people to be able to read the Bible and to become students of the Christian way of life. and to enter into Christian society. The curriculum involves studying the ancient languages primarily, Greek and Latin, sometimes Hebrew as well. They studied geometry, philosophy, theology. They read the classical authors. They would have read Plutarch and Thucydides, etc. All of that was background information for them to be able to become students of the Bible and to become members of their productive members of their society. Most of the schools, there were not a lot of schools, but most of the schools were owned by religious organizations and operated accordingly. But the schools were expensive, and there weren't many people that could afford to attend the schools, so a lot of education occurred at home. It must have been fairly productive with respect to literacy, because in 1840, the literacy rate in America was over 90%. That was the style and the form of education that dominated in American life until about 1840, when things began to shift dramatically. And the shift in education that takes place reflects a shift that's happening in the culture as a whole. And I'm going to use one person, one individual, as an example of what's going on there. And my information comes from a book that came out about 5 or 6 years ago that I found very interesting. It's called The Metaphysical Club by Louis Menand. And in this book, he traces the development of thought of 5 American scholars who all knew one another. They were all from New England. And for a short period of time, a very short period of time, they were all together in this one discussion group called the Metaphysical Club. But those 5 individuals went on to set the tone for the intellectual life of America for the rest of the 1800s and well into the 1900s. And those included the 2 James brothers, not the robbers, the other James brothers. Stanley Pierce, I think, was one of those, and Oliver Wendell Holmes. And Oliver Wendell Holmes is the one that I'll be talking about. Oliver Wendell Holmes, like all of the others, was born in New England, which was dominated by the Puritan culture there. So he was from a religiously conservative area, well-educated, as most Puritans were. He was the oldest of this group of 5. He was an abolitionist, as were his parents and as were many of the people in New England. So when the Civil War broke out, he was a young man, and he entered into the army for the North to fight in favor of freeing the slaves. But he had a very momentous, I guess, experience serving in the Civil War. He was an officer. He was a low-level officer, had a platoon of men that were assigned to him. And he, by all accounts, was a good officer. But he observed many atrocities, both by the Army of the North and the South, as a result of his service. And he developed 2 biases over the period of time that he served in the Civil War. And these 2 biases became very important in the rest of his life. The first was the conclusion that the war was caused by dogmatic Christians. What he observed is that we have 2 armies, both of them claiming that they have the right to annihilate the other army, and that right was given to them by the Christian God. And he thought that it was absolutely unthinkable that the same Christian God would be authorizing that kind of slaughter. A quote from Menand's book: "The lesson Holmes took from the war can be put in a sentence. it is that certitude leads to violence. If the conviction of rightness is powerful enough, resistance to it will be met sooner or later by force. There are people like this in every sphere of life, and it is natural to feel that the world would be a better place without them. So he took a dramatic turn towards secularism as a result of his experience in the Civil War. The other change in thought, he began to be intrigued with expertise, professionalism. As he was fighting on the battlefield, he encountered opposition from Southern commanders, and what he observed is they were very good. They were good at what they did, and he came to admire that. And what he saw is there's a kind of knowledge that can bring people together over cultural divides. And he saw it as a very good thing. So professionalism as a way of knowing something became very important to him. Another quote from Anand's book. Professionalism means disciplinary autonomy. A field of study or any line of work is a profession when its practitioners are answerable for the content of their work only to fellow practitioners and not to persons outside the field. Peer review. One of the things that held back scientific education in American colleges was the dominance of theology in the curriculum, which obliged scholars in every field to align their work with Christian orthodoxy. So both of these developments in his thought push him in the direction of thinking that secularism, a move towards secularism, would be a good thing for America. And he's not alone in that perspective in the middle of the 1800s. He's joined by many who are seeing a need for putting distance between Christianity and American culture. None of them are advocating dispensing with Christianity completely, at least not publicly. They're not wanting to dispense with Christianity completely. They just see a need to put a little bit of gap in there, that there are a lot of benefits that would come from that. Most of them remain Christians to one degree or another, but they want that gap to be created. Oliver Wendell Holmes then went on to become a Supreme Court justice. So this shift towards secularism is a gentle but perceptible shift that's happening in the intellectual culture across the board in America in the middle of the 1800s. As a result, then, it's during this period of time that the push for public schools in America becomes significant and begins to gain traction. Horace Mann was the one who led that effort. He was a Christian from New England, but he too felt that it would benefit American culture if we could put a bit of a separation between the church and education. So he advocated schools to be set up that would be independent from the churches, that would be dependent upon the state. And that would have a number of very important benefits. It would produce good citizens. It would unite the society. And it would prevent crime and poverty. Notice this is quite a shift from the goal of education that was established in the colonies. He wanted a separation from church and church control, but he still wanted Christian values to be taught in the school, but they should be more generic Christian values. They should be more generic kind of Christian morality rather than theology or dogmatism. So public schools were first established in Massachusetts in 1853. Then they were established in other states, several other states, within the next 5 years. So it spread very rapidly. Once public schools became established, then there were other developments that happened within the public schools, and I'm going to jump ahead to the early 1900s with John Dewey. John Dewey saw the public schools then as a very important vehicle by which America could solve some of its social problems. One of the problems that he saw at this particular point in time was a huge influx of immigrants from Europe. Prior to this, there had been immigrants coming in from Europe, but most of them were from the British Isles. And culturally, they weren't so different from the Americans. But now immigrants are starting to come in not just from Germany and Italy and Spain and France, but they're coming from further east. They're coming from Bohemia. They're coming from Romania. They're coming from former Yugoslavia. So they're coming from more exotic cultures, and the question is, how do you blend these together? It's hard enough to blend Scots and Irishmen in with American culture. How are we going to blend these cultures in with American culture? And John Dewey saw that as a monumental problem that had to be solved. His solution was to use the public schools. That if all of their children come to school at the age of 6, and if they are all taught the same content, they all read the same books, they all study the same textbooks, they all learn the same math, if they all are put into this school that is a little model of American culture at large, that has its own student government and its own shop classes and its home economics classes, so it teaches them all the customs that we have in America as to how we run a household. And if they're all on the same sports teams and have the same, and they have cheerleaders, then that will fix everything. That will make them little Americans. By the time they come out, they'll be little Americans. It doesn't matter who their parents were. So the public schools then became this vehicle that would allow us to homogenize America out of all of these diverse groups, homogenize America and produce people who share the same set of values. And you can see a lot of those features in our public schools yet today. There's another thing that was happening at this time in the late 1800s that is also significant in the development of education in America. And that's something that's happening worldwide, and I'm going to tell the story of the Crimean War, and it may seem like the Crimean War is quite far removed from American education. And in some ways it is, but in some ways it isn't. After the French Revolution, Napoleon was defeated by an alliance of military forces from throughout Europe. But the country that supplied the most forces for that effort and was most active in defeating Napoleon was the Russian army. So at the conclusion of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, world opinion held it that the strongest military in the world was the Russian military, primarily because it was so large. They were able to put an enormous army in the field. That's what they did against Napoleon, and everybody feared the might of the Russian army. For reasons that I won't get into, there was a conflict that developed in the Balkans between Russia and particularly England. England was protective of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was collapsing. Russia wanted that land. They had wanted that land for a long time. And it appeared to England that Russia was going to take this opportunity to grab the Ottoman Empire, and in particular Constantinople, and control the straits into the Mediterranean Sea. So England went to war against Russia. They fought this war in the Crimea, which was was Russian territory. England was joined by France and the mighty forces from Sardinia. And this alliance took on Russia. France and England sent relatively small armies to fight the battle, and Sardinia sent, I don't know, a couple dozen soldiers. But they had a relatively small army. They went to war against Russia on Russian soil. The English and French won. In a relatively short period of time, in about a year, they soundly defeated the Russians on their own territory. How could that possibly happen? Well, Russia could put a huge army in the field if only the army could get there. Russia had a huge army, but they didn't have roads, they didn't have vehicles, they didn't have any way to move that army around quickly. And once they got the army there, they didn't have any way of getting them supplied with food and material. Furthermore, the French and the British had these little boats that gave them a great deal of mobility that they could get around and move their point of attack, knowing that the Russians couldn't adjust very quickly because the Russians were real slow to move. Also, the French had developed a new weapon. Prior to this, guns were muskets. Muskets are guns with a smooth bore. The problem with a musket is when you shoot it, the ball that comes out kind of like a knuckleball. And it'll go straight for a while, but then you never know where it's going to go. It'll swerve right, down, up. You never know where it's going to go. So its accuracy is quite limited. I think, if my recollection is correct, it's about 100 yards. The French had developed a different kind of gun. They came up with what's called rifling. They drilled into the barrel of the gun this spiral pattern so that when the projectile came out, it had spiral on it, and it would go straight much further, three times as far. So the French were able to get off about two or three shots at the Russian army that were accurate before the Russian army could fire an accurate bullet back. It transformed the war. Furthermore, they didn't use balls. They used these bullets that flared out. I just need a blackboard. They flared out at the end, so when the explosion happened, it would push this flange out, snug up against the barrel, and it would go a lot further and a lot faster. Those two innovations transformed the war. And as a result, a relatively small force of French and English defeated the Russians on Russian soil. That was devastating to the Russians. So they went back home and did some soul searching. What is wrong? What do we have to do? And what they concluded is, we need a better military. And in order to have a better military, we need better technology. In order to have better technology, we need better industry. In order to have better industry, we need better education. In order to have better education, we need to do a whole bunch of stuff. But it included freeing their serfs, their slaves, because 90% of the population was serfs or slaves, and they were afraid of having educated serfs and slaves. If you're going to train them, if you're going to make them capable, you better make them free. So what they realized is they were in a position in history where they had to completely transform their society in order to be militarily competitive. In other words, they had to completely modernize in order to survive. And that's the lesson that was learned all over the world at this particular point in time. Modernize or die. And everybody then starts to take seriously the need to develop a healthy industry, and in order to do that, a healthy a healthy technology. And technology requires education. So there was a small principality in Europe that learned this lesson, and that was Prussia. Prussia was just one of many principalities in what is now Germany. They are the descendants of the Teutonian Knights way back in the time of the Crusades, when the Pope didn't know what to do with them after the Crusades was over, and he said, well, then go to Prussia and fight against the Lithuanians. So it was a group of people that from its very base and foundation was used to a military way of life. And they decided that in order for them to survive, they needed to start changing their society in a way that would make them survivable. And they learned the lesson of the Russians, and that is, we need to transform it and create a society that has good education so it can have good technology, so it can have good industry, so it can have a good military. And that's what they did. They transformed the society entirely. And very soon thereafter, they emerged as the central power in Russia, and it was around Prussia then, not Russia, Germany, and it was around Prussia then that Germany became a nation in the late 1800s. As a part of this effort, they developed a new form of university. They decided that the universities that had existed before needed to be completely transformed into a more efficient model, one that would produce the kind of technology that they wanted to have. So what they did is they decided every professor needs to be a researcher. And in order to do research, they need time. We don't want them in the classroom all the time. We want them to only spend a certain amount of time in the classroom, and the rest of the time, we want them in the lab, working on state-of-the-art research. Well, how are we going to teach the people that we need to teach and still have them in the lab half the time? They came up with a great idea, the lecture hall. If the teachers were to give lectures to a huge number of people, they could teach a whole bunch of people more efficiently. And then they could have more time to spend in the labs. And when they go into the labs, it will be required that they take advanced students with them, and those advanced students will be mentored as to how to conduct research. And once trained in how to conduct research, they would become the next generation of teachers in the university. So that's the model that they created. Americans came and looked at what their Prussians had done and were amazed. They thought it was very effective, very efficient, and that model was transplanted to the United States, and that has become the model of education on which our modern universities are built. That's what a research university is. It's patterned after the Prussian model. At about this same time, there was another development, and that was the decision to develop land-grant colleges. Land-grant colleges were colleges that were funded by the federal government giving land that it owned, to the college, and that land was used in two ways. One, it was used as a place where the campus could be located, but other land was given to them as a way of making money, in income production. That other land might be forests, it might be mines, it might be any number of things. Well, the land-grant colleges came into being. One of the reasons that people wanted these land-grant colleges was to put more separation between education and the church. So these land-grant colleges would not be church-run. These would be state-owned. They would be secular. Secondly, they would have an emphasis placed on research. Initially, it was research in agriculture and mining. As time went on, that expanded. Engineering and some other things were thrown. Oh, military tactics, those kinds of things were added into it. But the land-grant colleges were supposed to be primarily research-based institutions. And that was part of the condition for being a land-grant college. That's significant in a couple of ways. One is they then become the model for college education across the country using the Prussian pattern. The second is all of a sudden we have a huge influx of new colleges, and they are all secular. As a result of these changes, then, education in America, in colleges, but it also made its way down through the lower grades as well, education became much more secular than it had been before the 1840s. It is also much more vocationally oriented. It becomes primarily training for the workplace. And it takes on a huge component of doing research. They become research institutions. One of the results of this transformation, especially the secularization, is education then became much more vulnerable to the intellectual fads of the Western world. And schools begin to become experimental playgrounds for various theories of education that get played out over the next several decades. In the middle of this transformation of American education, the same kinds of changes are happening in Europe as well. They're parallel. They're mirrored in Europe as well. C.S. Lewis, who was teaching, I think he was at Cambridge at this time, but he may have been at Oxford. He was observing this transformation as it was happening in England. And he wrote a series of lectures that were subsequently put into a book called The Abolition of Man, in which he's kind of looking at this transformation and critiquing it. And I read that recently. I thought it might be helpful for my comments today, and I was right. It's extremely helpful for what I'm talking about here. So I reread it, and I'm going to take you through what he argues in this book, and I'll do it relatively briefly. But I highly encourage that you read it. The whole thing is online, so you can find it readily. It's very interesting. It's only about 130 pages long. The occasion for the book is he received a book to review, and he decides not to even name the book. He's not interested in defaming anyone. He just wants to interact with the ideas that are presented there. So he refers to it as the Green Book. In this Green Book, the authors are trying to teach people how to write and to write better. And early on in the book, they make the observation that, and I can't remember who it's some great writer from the past, was interacting with another individual, and the other individual said, that waterfall is beautiful. And this other great writer said, no, that waterfall is sublime. And the authors of the Green Book are critiquing this little conversation. And what they say is, neither one is saying anything real about the waterfall. All they're saying is, the one is saying, I have feelings of beautifulness when I look at that waterfall. And the other one is saying, I have feelings, I have sentiments of sublimity when I look at that waterfall. But neither one is saying anything about the waterfall. And that's where Lewis jumps in with both feet. Lewis argues that until recent times, you could go back to any culture, any time, they believed that there was a reality out there and that we could make meaningful statements about that reality. We could even make value judgments about things in that reality. And that was actually the basis for education. Education was designed to train people to be able to make sense of that reality out there and to learn the values that are built into the universe. He says that's the perspective that you get from Plato, from Aristotle, from the Stoics, from the Christians, from Oriental religions. All of them share that in common. So as he proceeds through the book, he decides to use the word Tao for the Chinese word for that notion. And he just refers to it to the Tao because he says, we're not talking about any specific religion here. We're just talking about the common experience of man, that until very recent times, everyone has believed that there is a reality out there that we can know and that we can understand the values that are built into it. One quote from his book. Until quite modern times, all teachers and even all men believed the universe to be such that certain emotional reactions on our part could be either congruous or incongruous to it. Believed, in fact, that objects did not merely receive but could merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence or our contempt. And then later he describes this universal, this Tao. He says, it is nature. It is the way, the road. It is the way in which the universe goes on, the way in which things everlastingly emerge, stilly and tranquilly into space and time. It is also the way which every man should tread in imitation of that cosmic and supercosmic progression, conforming all activities to that great exemplar. So that's the way it had been in the past, and that formed the basis for education. And what he's observing is, by making the claim that the authors of the Green Book have made, they've done away with the Tao. They want to go on then and teach us values. They just think that they have gotten rid of all the bad values by getting rid of the Tao. They'll keep the good values and they'll teach those to us. He says, their skepticism about values is on the surface. It is for use on other people's values, about the values current in their own set. They are not nearly skeptical enough. And this phenomenon is very usual. A great many of those who debunk traditional, or as they would say, sentimental values, have in the background values of their own, which they believe to be immune from the debunking process. So they think that they can get rid of the Tao, that concept of values being built into reality. They think they can get rid of that, but still retain the values that are near and dear to them. And Lewis says, you can't do it. That can't be done. This thing, which I have called for convenience the Tao, and which others may call natural law, or traditional morality, or the first principles of practical reason, or the first platitudes, is not one among a series of possible systems of value. It is the sole source of all value judgments. If it is rejected, all value is rejected. If any value is retained, it is retained. So he's saying what they've done is they've gotten rid of the basis for values completely. There ceases to be a basis for values on which one can stand. In this book, Lewis then goes on to talk about the implications of getting rid of that. And what he says is that is just one step in this process that man has embarked on of trying to control nature. And he says some very interesting things about nature coming back as a result of that and controlling us in a new and greater way. It's very interesting and very prescient. But I won't talk about that today. But along the way, as he argues this, he says getting rid of the Tao has implications for education. Once you get rid of it, what is education supposed to do? What's its basis? What's its purpose? What's its goal? He says, hence the educational problem is wholly different according as you stand within or without the Tao. For those within, the task is to train in the pupil those responses which are in themselves appropriate, whether anyone is making them or not, and in making which the very nature of man consists. Those without, if they are logical, must regard all sentiments as equally non-rational, as mere mists between us and the real object. As a result, they must either decide to remove all sentiments as far as possible from the pupil's mind, or else to encourage some sentiments for reasons that have nothing to do with their intrinsic justness or ordinancy. The latter course involves them in the questionable process of creating in others by suggestion or incantation a mirage which their own reason has successfully dissipated. He goes on and says this same, repeats the same idea very succinctly. He says, in a word, the old was a kind of propagation, men transmitting manhood to men. The new is merely propaganda. As he describes it then, the inevitable result of doing away with the Tao is transforming men into these grotesque monsters, into caricatures of themselves. And he describes this kind of grotesque monster, a man without chests. Let me read one paragraph here where he talks about this. It's a great image. The operation of the Green Book and its kind is to produce what may be called men without chests. It is an outrage that they should be commonly spoken of as intellectuals. This gives them the chance to say that he who attacks them attacks intelligence. It is not so. They are not distinguished from other men by any unusual skill in finding truth or any virginal ardor to pursue her. Indeed, it would be strange if they were. A persevering devotion to truth, a nice sense of intellectual honor, cannot be long maintained without the aid of a sentiment, which Gaius and Titius could debunk as easily as any other. That's a reference to earlier. It is not the excess of thought, but defect of fertile and generous emotion that marks them out. Their heads are no bigger than the ordinary. It is the atrophy of their chest beneath that makes them seem so. What he means by this is that the old perspective on education is that it's to train the human being such that he doesn't just act on the appetites. He doesn't just act on his belly. That his mind has to be trained, and it needs to be trained to rein in its belly. And that's done through, and there the chest is that mediation between the mind and the belly. And what he's saying is, by doing away with the Tao, you create men who have no chest that can mediate between the mind and the belly. And as a result, they act on appetite. They have ceased to be men. So education, as he has noticed in England, the same process has happened in America. That by becoming secularized, we left ourselves open to becoming relativized. That relativism reigns supreme in our educational system because it reigns supreme in our culture as a whole. And that means a fundamental change in education, a fundamental change in what education does. Education has become behavior training. Education is the way that we coerce students to behave according to the values that we deem important, that they hold to. And how do you achieve that? Any way that works. So it's become propaganda. Unfortunately, the Christian response to that has been to largely adapt the same procedure, but a different set of values. The Christian education is not distinctly different. We're in the same soup. We're absorbing the same ideas. We've been affected by the same set of problems. And as a result, we tend to see, even in Christian circles, we tend to see education as behavior training. And it's just a matter of getting students, coercing students to adopt the right set of values, a different set of values perhaps from the surrounding culture, but the process of doing that is largely the same. Well, what are the implications of this for freedom of thought? Insofar as education in America is vocational training, freedom of thought has this narrow place in our lives and in the educational scheme. We need innovation. We need new ideas. So there needs to be freedom of thought. But it's in a very narrow technical range. It's freedom of thought as to how big this gear should be. But it ought not go beyond the bounds of the discipline. Freedom of thought outside of the bounds of the discipline is useless to us. It's not encouraged. It's not helpful. Insofar as education is this training in values, freedom of thought is a problem. We don't want to foster students who have independent minds. We want students who embrace the set of values that we hold to be near and dear. We don't want them to second guess that. We just want them to embrace that. So the notion of political correctness, for instance, is closely tied to this. Keep people embracing the right set of values, whatever it takes to accomplish that. Now, a certain amount of deviation from the norm is allowed. That's absolutely true. But you can only deviate in certain directions. You can only embrace a certain set of values as long as they are all in line with the basic core values that are embraced by the culture. If you step beyond those bounds, then they come down hard. They like that pluralism because it makes them feel good about themselves. They're so free thinking. How is this done? You've probably all seen it. It happens in the classroom all the time. It happens in the universities. Those who have values that are outside of the accepted set of values are belittled, they're intimidated, and they're bullied. And it happens all the time. I'm sure most of you are aware of instances where that has happened. Certainly happens elsewhere in academia, and what Dr. Crocker was saying this morning is a good example of that kind of thing. Christian education has resorted to some of the same kinds of things. It may not be PC, political correctness, that reigns in Christian education, but it is dogmatism, and that's what Jack was talking about earlier. It's unfortunate we missed a great opportunity. We could have thought about education completely differently. Rather than just adopting the methods that are used in the secular world and instilling a different set of values, we could have returned to the notion of education that C.S. Lewis was talking about. But we missed that opportunity. And as a result, we have a culture that is, I think, uniformly anti-intellectual. That term was used before. I think Charlie used it, and I think it's absolutely true. It is ironic that Christian culture is condemned as being anti-intellectual. And there are absolutely there are anti-intellectual elements in Christian culture. And it may be predominantly anti-intellectual. But the people making the accusation are not free from the same charge. We have lost the art of dialogue, and that's what Jack was talking about. And that is across the culture completely. Watch television. Watch the news shows. I mean, are those actually debates? Are those actually dialogues that go on between Republicans and Democrats? Absurd. I mean, those are anti-intellectual shouting matches. Boy, compare it to the Federalist Papers or something like that. I mean, it's embarrassing. Okay, where do we go from here? There is some of this that overlaps a little bit with what Jack said. I can't help but overlap with what Jack said. There are some things here that I think need to happen across the board. The first thing that we need to recognize is that we were made to be knowers. God made us to be knowers. He made us so that we have sense perception. He made us so that we have minds that reason, that work. And we're intended to use those things. And we have a curiosity. If it isn't quenched at about the age of 2, then that curiosity is something that we can't help. We want to know. There is a reality out there. God put us in a universe. That universe exists. It operates according to certain principles. And those principles are of such a nature that they are, to one degree or another, knowable. God has matched us up. We are made to be knowers, and the universe was made to be known. It's complex. It's complicated. We will never know it all, but we can make great progress on it. And we can understand the most basic principles that undergird it. And we have a responsibility to live out our lives according to the way that God made the universe, to find our proper place in it and live accordingly. Every one of us has that responsibility. And as a result, we need to have trained and active minds that are trying to put things together. We were also made to be makers of choices. We are choice makers. We make hundreds of choices every day. And it's those choices that we make that define who we are. It's those choices that are the most important thing that we do. It's making considered choices. It's making choices that are consistent with the principles that are built into the universe that separates us from the animals. And it's those, in particular, moral decisions that define our lives and our existence. And it's those choices that we make of our own free will, uncoerced and unmanipulated, that count. To the extent that we make choices with some gun held to our head, we don't consider those moral choices. We're forced to do that. It's the unforced choices that determine who we are. And in order to be the choice makers that we were made to be, we have to have the freedom to make those choices. The freedom to think through what is it that I should do, and then the freedom to act on that. Okay, if that's the way it is, what is the role of education? The role of education, then, is to help one another gain a clearer understanding of the reality that's out there. It's a process that we're all engaged in. It doesn't matter how old we are, how young we are. We're all engaged in that process. So education is just those that are more experienced in this process helping those who are less experienced in that process. But it is always, in a sense, peer helping peer, in the sense that we are all made in the image of God. We are all equal in that sense. We are all equally choosers. We are all equally persons. We share the same personhood. As a result, we don't have the prerogatives of God. Other people are people, we can help them, but we ought not coerce them, we ought not steer them. They are independent agents before God, and we need to remember that. At some point, we cross a bound. We're interfering in their lives in a way that we ought not do. It's playing God in their lives. And it's a violation of their personhood. So in the education process, there has to be respect. Respect for the other people around us, in particular respect of the teacher towards the student. And understanding that we as teachers play a little tiny role in their lives. And it will always be just a little tiny role in their lives. Now, by a little tiny role, it can be significant. It is often significant. But in the bigger picture, it's only a little part of what's happening in their lives. That means that education is inherently risky. You're training students to become capable, and you don't know what those students are going to do with that capability. And it's not your right to control it. You're taking some risk. But what we have to acknowledge is that the real teacher here, the one that plays the big part, we just play this little part, and it's a part that's granted to us. The one who plays the bigger part is God. God is the one that can really teach. God is the one who can really transform souls. God is the one who can really bring wisdom. And to the extent that he allows us to play a little part in that, that's a wonderful gift that he grants us. But he's the one that's doing it primarily. And as a result, it is a matter of trusting in God in this whole process, that he will bring it about in a way that keeps us and our interests in mind and the interests of our students in mind. He knows what he's doing, and his purposes are good with respect to us. If that's what education is, freedom of thought is absolutely critical. It's not just a slogan. It has to be a value that is deep in our souls. It's something that we truly believe in. And that works its way out in every interaction that we have with our students. And without freedom of thought, we are violating the personhood of the students. And that we ought not do. Trust, carrying out education in this manner is ultimately trusting God, and it's ultimately a matter of faith. But it's an important thing that has to be done. And I think education in America needs to be transformed, needs to be redone. We need to regain a concept of what education is all about and pursue that diligently and carefully. Okay. Thanks. I'm done.